Lord. Even though, after reading the books and all that, I agree with much of what, get his tongue working today, that she had to say. The problem was, is that I've been counseling all my life. And if somebody calls you on the phone, spits out 3.5 sentences, and then you give an answer that's going to change their whole lives, that is really dangerous. You don't know much at all. And she would give sometimes the most dramatic advice. It would be so powerful and direct. And it was, you know, one of these, once you're on that path, you can't back out of it again kind of approaches. You know, it would just make me cringe to listen to her. Be careful, people. She wasn't getting near enough data to make the judgments that she was making. When she wrote a book, she made a lot of sense. She'd sit down, she'd think about it, you know, work through it. A lot of people are that way. It's just not that simple. And right here, we're going to find out that even as it was true on her show, it's certainly true in your lives, somebody could get up and say essentially, exactly. I'm going to have to write this class when I do that. I've got to go to the screen there, start a Word document to type it for you to get talking tonight. But, you know, you have to look at the circumstances and choose what to do. If somebody arrived with one statement, another person might arrive with an identical statement, but if you knew the rest of the story, then you give contradictory advice one to the other. One should do this, the other should do that. Go ahead.
If you had somebody, and there are plenty of them out there, who believe that the whole moon trip was all a hoax,
okay,
if you try to get into an argument with them because they studied it from the perspective of all the things, you try to get in there with their kind of logic and prove it, you're not going to be able to prove it. You're just showing folly to them. Whereas if you could take them to a telescope when the moon's in the right orbit, to have them look through and see something on the moon, then you might be able to prove something different.
Gerald made a wonderful point. Maybe I'm extending it a little farther than you might have intended, you know, but that's the kind of discussion I'm just never going to get in. You can't prove it. Now, she's right at the end. If you have some empirical evidence, it's absolutely undeniable, you got the big, you know, Hubble telescope in your backyard, you're able to do it, you know, well, fine. But in the meantime, what are you going to gain in that discussion? Do you need to prove to somebody that, you know, that they went to the moon and it wasn't fake in a Hollywood stage? You really don't need to. Carol's making a great point right there. She said, you're not going to convince them, you know, until you have that skull. You don't do it. But some things are important, and they do matter. They will have ramifications. And these verses are talking about them, verses 4 and 5. So let's take the first one in 26:4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest what? This is exactly what Carol just said. If you answer, if you get in that, you know, mud pit with them, you just wind up in the same circumstance they're in. You're not helping them, and you're making a fool out of yourself. So you have to pick your fight, is the way we usually put it, you know, but be careful here. Do not answer a fool according to his folly. Now, in this verse, because of what follows, lest you be like him, then what the qualifier there is, according to his folly, has to do with is the manner of presentation, the way it's going on. Now, I'm up on my horse today, you know, I get to tell you about all my pet peeves and everything. There's nothing I can't do is watch these TV shows, like one of them I think is called The Five, okay? And there are these talk show formats on your television. And what you'll have is several people sitting around a table, in this case, I think there's five of them, and then they all talk at once. And I sit there and I look at that, and they all just talk over each other, you know, and these are popular shows. There's loads of them. They have the same kind of a format, and it's all just, you know, pandemonium going on. And when you're all done, what have they resolved, solved, or conclusion have they reached? There's none whatsoever. It's all just kind of for the sake of the free-for-all right there. It's, look, if you're going to work with a folly, excuse me, with a fool, what is it you're trying to accomplish? I mean, if you choose to work with him, what are you trying to do? Root the folly out. Help him to become wise rather than foolish. You got an end in here. You got a game that you're trying to play so you can win and some kind of profit, you know, will come out of this. And it's not just for the exercise. So when you get in, a bunch of people talk over each other. Nobody's hearing anything anybody's saying. No argument is being developed in any kind of length at all. And when you're done, you have no resolution at all. Is this a way to spend an hour? Don't think so. All you've done is become like the fool. All you've done is promoted more folly. All you've done is wasted your time. Seems like in Ephesians we might have a command not to do that. We're supposed to redeem it. So in 26:4, what Solomon is saying is, you have to not only, remembering the three previous classes, you have to not only be able to first evaluate the circumstances, what kind of a person am I dealing with? Is this a fool or not? Then you have to judge, what manner am I going to make my presentation in if I decide to respond? How am I going to go about it? Never answer a fool according to his folly so that you become like them. If you become impatient, you're a fool. If you start shouting, you're a fool. If you see there's no hope in the discussion and you can't stop yourself, you're a fool. If you get caught up in any of these circumstances where no good can come out of it, don't answer the fool. Just be polite and walk away. You don't want to become like them. Now, we've seen plenty of Proverbs, and I'm not going to go back and rehearse it all. You really do want to finish up tonight, and so you can't be looking at all these, you know, but you learn these qualities and characteristics. We looked at lots of verses about the fool and prior to that in other contexts, where, for instance, you will learn anger. And we have a whole section on anger. That is learned. He said, don't spend time with people who are given to anger, lest you learn to be like him. We spend a lot of time with fools, and then you engage in conversation with them. What's happening? Who's doing the learning? And you are! And what are you learning to be? This is not good. So, in 26:4, don't answer the fool according to his folly. First, identify who the fool is. Evaluate the circumstances, success or failure. Then don't answer him the way he does, lest you wind up like him. What does 5 say? Answer a fool, and you'll note, if you have the New American Standard, that it does not read like, for instance, the King James. I think it is the King James and some others that will say, do not answer a fool according to his folly in verse 4, and then answer a fool according to his folly in verse 5. They're mirror images of each other, according to his folly. The New American Standard changed that, and they translated verse 5, answer a fool as his folly deserves, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, that certainly has to be the point of it, though I think the original translation where they say exactly the same thing is perfectly acceptable. It's a right translation. You know, what these translators have done is to recognize you've got different circumstances and obviously not in contradiction. And so we're not going to violate verse 4 in order to obey verse 5. There's something different going on. So you could translate it, answer a fool according to his folly, as long as you're attaching to those words now a different connotation. And by the way, raise your hand if you know the difference between a denotation and a connotation. You know the difference? Okay, y'all did this in school, I guess. A denotation is what the thing says by definition. Denotation is what it denotes. And that comes closer to being what we might call a translation. But what is a connotation? A connotation is when you're looking at the circumstances or the thing that's being said, and you realize that when you put all those words together, there's an idea or a concept that comes out of it that may be different than the strict denotation. Now, it's not a paraphrase. That's something else entirely, where you're putting in your own words what you think it means. But it is to say that in the construction of words and grammar and in language, you have, in every case, a denotation and a connotation. There's what the words say and then put together what they mean. And what the New American Standard has chosen to do here is to recognize the connotation
from the denotation and they put in the translation the connotation. That's a lot of nations in there, isn't it? But what that is to say it's still a translation. But it gives the sense in this manner. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, because at the end of verse 5, there's something that needs to be avoided. There's something you want to stop. And what is it? Leaving that fool thinking that he is wise. So again, this might have gone up here with the danger of fools. We looked at the first class with all these different categories of danger. There's a danger that you would become like the fool. There's also a danger that the fool goes away thinking he's wise. And you've got a problem when you meet a fool. Because before God, as Christians, we are supposed to be influencing and changing this world. And so it's our responsibility to try to promote and defend truth. That's our job. Carefully. So we don't do any harm or damage to ourselves or anybody else. But you also don't want that fool going away thinking that he's so very smart. So I'm going to pick up on what we did on the Sunday morning class. How many of you were in the Acts class on Sunday morning? Remember how I went to this? This was great, a huge percentage of it. See how far we went through this business about passages that teach that you're supposed to argue. The Bible's full of arguing. Okay? Do you want to be argumentative? Whoops. See, all of a sudden, there's denotation and connotation. The connotation that comes out of that is that you're just kind of nasty, and you know, you're off-putting, and you're not really helping. And so what you do, you need to argue, but you need to argue as the fool deserves. So what I always do with those people who argue that you should never argue is I never let them go home without pointing out that you've sure spent a lot of time arguing that we should never argue. It stops them every time, and it's just comical to watch. Let them run as long as possible. It's helpful. Because usually you go, you're not watching my watch here. You just spent 5 minutes to money 30 seconds arguing that we shouldn't argue. Doesn't that feel kind of funny? See, I think you're right to argue that you shouldn't argue. Because arguing is right. Now, your argument fails, you're wrong, and you've proven yourself wrong by effectively arguing that you should argue. I think you won the case. But you won it by arguing the wrong case. You have been arguing because you argue that one should argue. But you were arguing that you shouldn't argue, which is wrong. You should use that effective skill you have to argue the truth. That arguing is right. Now, once you've done that with somebody, and Carol was talking about this in the hallway as we came in, you have, like Stephen before you, done what to their argument? What was the word? Confounded their argument. You turned them, you upended, you know, the whole thing. So, a bunch of fools come to Jesus. Because they don't recognize him as the Son of the Living God, miracle-working prophet who will save the world. Okay? And they say, well then, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? What do you do? You know, just blew that argument so sky high and smithereens, you know, that there was, it was just atomized. And everybody knew it. What did Jesus do there? He answered the fool according to his folly by presenting an argument that demonstrated the utter falsity of their entire premise. They missed the point that there are two different realms here, and he needed to function in both of them. And so, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and in a single sentence, what has he done? He has exposed the fool's folly and left himself standing as what kind of man? A wise man and not a fool. Now, we all understand Jesus can do this off the cuff. He's the Son of the Living God. What are you and I going to have to do? We'll probably have to think a few minutes before we get to that kind of response. But that's what the book of Proverbs, that's what the book of Ecclesiastes, that's what your whole Bible is all about, is teaching us then how to be able to do that. How to be able to undo the argument so that the individual is absolutely stopped in their tracks. Okay, so in 26:5, one last time,
answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. You're going to try to humble. That's not necessarily to humiliate, though on occasion Jesus did that too. But you are going to try to humble that individual. This will seldom be done with a whole lot of words. This will usually most effectively be done if they do most of the talking. You do only a little. But you've so well analyzed the circumstances, your opponent, and everything here, and then chosen how you're going to answer, that when you finally do speak, like Jesus did, it's the end of the argument. Well, Lord, you know, we had a levirate marriage, and so there were seven guys that married her, and now she's dead too, and in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Well, they had her, didn't they? After that discussion, it says they wouldn't ask him any more questions. What did he do? He took a passage of Scripture. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And not only was that argument over, but what had he done to all those people? They were afraid to even ask another question. Henceforth, he put an end to the entire, you know, debate. So that's not easy for us to do, but it is commanded in 26, 4 and 5 that you learn how to make these decisions and then deliver these answers in a manner that humbles or causes at least this fool to question his argument and himself. Anybody else? Comment or question? Yeah, go.
Some months ago, I was playing a game online and there was a chat room box sort of decided for anybody that wanted to traverse. And I think, as it was, somebody had asked if people pray for a certain person or something in that order, and this woman commented that she didn't believe in God. And I commented, the fool says in their heart there is no God. And she came back, she said, you're a fool if you believe. And I said, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. She didn't come back, and I didn't either.
Okay.
I knew I won. Everybody saw what I said, but she shut up.
Okay. A very brief exchange can have profound results, can it not? Yeah. And in this case, how much of Bill's own reasoning did he present? None. Okay. Who is she arguing with? With the Lord. Now, brethren, that's another thing that I've done quite a bit that seems to, you know, be effective with people when they're doing all this arguing and everything, you know, is they will always attack you. You're arrogant. You think you're the only ones going to heaven. You think you're the only ones that know the truth. You think your way of understanding the Scriptures, you know, is the only way to understand it. The way I usually respond with that is to say, you know, really, all I'm asking you to do is to read Scriptures that disagree with what you say. I didn't write them. I'm just reading them. So your argument really, and this is what Bill has just said and done, you know, your argument really is not with me. Please don't attack me. I didn't construct this argument. It isn't my idea. I'm just reading these passages. I think I might have told you the story in a different context. I'll do it very quickly here again, but how confused people get on these things. I had a really good friend who in his early 20s was asked to preach a sermon on parenting. I must have told you this story when we were doing a parenting thing. He got up, and for 30 minutes, he did nothing but read Scripture, and he never offered one syllable of his own understanding, ideas, or advice. And when that sermon was over, what happened? He had several people just come up to him and tear him to pieces. Who do you think you are, as an unmarried man with no children, to be given advice on child raising? Had he given any advice on child raising? None. Who had? God had. But what were they doing? They were attacking him. They were arguing with him. You know, they were taking issue with him. He wasn't involved in this. The Lord was. You'll find this is the case very much in all your interactions with people out there in the world that you're trying to help. They're going to come against you. Who did they kill first? Jesus. Who did they kill next? The apostles, who they've been killing for centuries after that. Okay, but all of these people were only doing what? Presenting the Scripture. They weren't inventing new religions, Jesus was, but they were just Be thinking, you know, the argument's not with the guy, it's with the message. Was it Michael next thing you're going to have?
I just have a question. When you start to get into an exchange or something like that, that you have a good team to say for when you're saying you're arguing with God, when you point out that it's in the Bible, they're saying somebody's wrote that. I mean,
yeah.
Is there something there to say? I should never come up with.
Well, what I always do is I just say, you know, you have just raised a very important question. It's even more important than the topic we're talking about.
Okay.
And then I would just say, you know, I have access to books and tapes and all kinds of material on the topic of whether or not the Bible is trustworthy. Okay. And then I just challenge them to study that. Typically what I'll do is just say, have you ever read a book on Christian apologetics, or textual accuracy, or what they call the transmission of the scriptures and how they came through the ages? Have you ever read a book on a translation like the King James Version? One came out here about 4 or 5 years ago on the translators of the King James Version, which is a fascinating book. They never have.
Right.
I mean, it's just, if one does, it'll just be so unusual, it'll just be astonishing. And you'll just say, well, and here's what you do. You say, well, okay, well, I've read such books and material, and I've become convinced, you know, on the truth of this book. So, if you've been doing such study, why don't we get together and study that and you show me where I was wrong?
Okay.
So, in the end, brethren, what do you want above all else? Opportunity to study with people. I don't care if they're for you or against you. Okay. What you need is an opportunity to study. So study. And, you know, it's just, if you do it right, people can hardly refuse. Because they know that if they refuse, they are admitting that either their argument or their character is deficient. If you set it up properly, they will absolutely realize, if I don't agree to study, I'm either admitting my argument is wrong or my character is weak. Because most people, you know, are kind of trapped in. They're going to have to do so. So that's why we're going to say, fine, boy, that'd be a better topic than we had. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's say that. Okay. Bill.
Over 4.5 years ago, Jerry gave us a listing in one of our church books, which I kept, of various historical documents that are accepted by science and historians, where there's very few documents, and they're accepted. Yet, the New Testament has 20,000 plus documents that have been found. And people are still trying to refute these. I think that's good information.
Amen. Jerry, looks like you got some printing to do. Or reprinting to do anyway. Yeah, you know what he's talking about. He can show you the one he's got. Bring it in, you know. We'll distribute it in the Sunday morning class. Because it fits probably Acts, you know, better there. Okay, so after chapter 26, verses 4 and 5, skip down to 12. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. Now, I want you to think about this one because, you know, the truth of it is maybe obvious, but I put it in this category here of how to handle fools. So now what I'm asking is digest this. And what did it tell you to do? It's not just stating a fact, it's giving advice. What's the advice?
Save your head and walk away.
Carol?
Not to be so full of yourself that you don't consider the other opinion or the other side.
Okay, and both of those are true. Bill, you know, beat you to the draw there. I waved my hand in the same direction. But see, both of these are so. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? Well, do you want to be one of them? No, you don't. There's more hope for a fool than for him. But if you see a man who's wise in his own eyes, then what? Probably time to make your escape, isn't it? You'd be looking for the door. You're going to spend the rest of your life doing this, and it isn't going to accomplish anything. All right, now 29:20, last in this section on how to handle fools, 29:20. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than him. The exact same
final sentence in those two proverbs. There's more hope for a fool than for him. Word for word, verbatim, they're identical. So, do you see a man wise in his own eyes? Do you see a man who's hasty in his words? BT. Okay? Time to bail. There's not much hope. There's not any hope. Don't become one, and don't waste your time. I never heard that story at all. That hurts. There were very few of you that were here Sunday afternoon by the time all this unfolded, but did you see we had a visitor Sunday morning, came in at the back there. Mark was here for a while. I think Dean, you know, were hanging out, protecting me, I think is what they were doing, and I really appreciate it, too. It was very clear we had a guy, you know, that real scruffy, you know, and apparently, you know, has desires. And so the way that turned out for you guys that were here, is that finally, you know, he came to me. He wasn't satisfied with everybody. They, you know, came down to me and wanted to talk to me. I'm the preacher. You know, so I'm fine. Olds were waiting for us, you know, over at the restaurant. I was feeling real bad because now I know we got people waiting. We're trying to get out. And this guy, you know, started giving his spiel, you know, similar kind of thing I've heard just 1,000 times. But what was really interesting about this one was finally, you know, I got him up and I walked out, you know, and I got out on the front porch because he was beginning to scare me, and I wanted to be separated from Donna and, you know, anybody else. So I got him outside, door closed behind me, we're out on the porch right there. And so finally it just came really down to it, and he's getting mad, because I told him over and over again, I just said, well, now look, you know, there are missions and houses and programs, you know, that you can go to. You can go to Eugene, and he just over and over, he said, I'm not going to do that. He said, I won't do it. Somebody will steal my computer. So, well, you know, that's the program. I'm not going to give you any money. Those places are designed for these kinds of things. I'm not going to do it. Finally, this guy actually says to me, he says, so I've wasted this whole hour? I could have gone down and been with a Baptist instead of you. What am I dealing with? Does he have any interest in the truth? Does he have any interest, you know, at all?
No.
I looked at him and I said, well, you probably should have done that. It would have been better for both of us. And I turned around, I walked away, and he called me one of the world's most obscene things that you can imagine. Don't imagine. So it proves himself. But what is it all about? Every time I tried to interject something, this guy was the epitome of 2920. Hasty in his words. Wasn't the least bit interested in anything that I could offer except one thing. What was that?
Money.
He wanted money. He told us, you know, what I'm going to do, my bicycle's broken, I had to push it all the way over here. So he swore at me, Don, I got in the car. By the time we got to the corner, he was half a mile away riding his bicycle. Real broken. See, ultimately, he wasted a lot of our time yesterday. He really did. All told, I guess the guy had absorbed at least 30 minutes of, you know, three different people, you know, being added up like that. Solomon knows this. And so Solomon is trying to help us to understand. Now, I could have turned around and gotten in his guy's face. You know, I could have taken offense at the way, you know, he was treating me and all the rest of that. But what good is it going to do? What am I dealing with? I'm dealing with a fool and his folly. You know, so I just turned my back and I walked away. I've got to tell you, I kept a close eye on my back and herded my wife into the car, you know, told her, this guy's angry now, I think he's dangerous. And so, you know, we kind of fled the scene, and then I drove around for a while to make sure he left and didn't do any damage to the place because he was, you know, pretty frustrated. But that's the end, brethren, of this section. And we now have miscellaneous that's going to come up. So we're going to wrap it up, you know, and with that story. Fools are really dangerous. That guy could have burnt this building down.
That guy could have done any little pull to Malahar. He could be walking in here, you know, with his six-shooter any minute now. You can't control the world. You never know what you're going to come up against. But you're trying to do the best you can to identify everybody that is teachable. And then let your words be with grace, seasoned with salt that you what? You know how to answer every man. And then, if you're dealing with the fool, protect yourself, protect those you love, because they can be fatal. Make your escape as quickly as you can. So we went through these proverbs in the way that we did. We started off with all the danger. There were a whole lot of different kinds of dangers. Then we looked at all these characteristics and identifying who these people are. We've ended up then with a discussion of a night and a half, you know, with how to handle, how to work with these kinds of people while you're consciously protecting yourself and, you know, watching out so you're not getting yourself in some kind of trouble there. Are there any comments or questions then before we just go to some that I couldn't quite categorize? They were just kind of all sort of standalone kind of things. In that package now of dangers, identifications, and procedures, do you have any comments or thoughts? That's the fool. So, we got 20 minutes to get through about 10 or 12 verses here, so now we're going to be wandering all over. But go to chapter 10 and verse 23. Chapter 10 and verse 23. Doing wickedness is like sport to a fool, and so is wisdom to a man of understanding. Now, what is sport? Yes. Sports really are enjoyable. I know you get the higher levels of professional sport and all that. It's pretty painful too. You know, you got to work hard and all the rest of that. But, you know, sport, if you say sport, it's something that you would choose to do. You would desire to do. And you enjoy doing. You derive pleasure from a sport. So you seek to participate in it. Wickedness is like that to a fool. They love it. They're proud of it. They take satisfaction in it. It is enjoyable. It pleases them. Righteousness does not do that for them. Okay? Now, who are you looking to bring to Christ? Jesus said the sower went out to sow. We have four different kinds of soil. Okay? Would you consciously choose to sow all your seed on the road because you want to saw seed on the road grow up, you know, and be a good, healthy plant? Well, wouldn't you make a choice? Well, sure. And this is what Solomon does in his books of wisdom, is help us to make those choices. So we're trying to sow this seed in what kind of a heart? Look at the last half of the verse. The kind that enjoys wisdom. The kind that enjoys it and would participate in is pursuing it. What you're looking for in the world today, brethren, and you have to ask every single one of the now, what, 7 billion people on the planet to find out if they are this or not. What you're looking for is a truth, what? A truth seeker. There are loads of people out there, way more I think than we even imagine, who really do want to know. They just haven't found it yet because they haven't found you yet because maybe you haven't found them yet. But they want to know. And so they might be exploring who knows what kind of, in that case, kind of stuff. Maybe they're all off into dope and drugs. But it may be because they were trying to find answers. Okay? And maybe they realize it doesn't work, they try it somewhere else. So you can't presume to just judge, you know, on sight. You have to explore. But whatever they look like, whatever they sound like, whatever they are, in any package, you can find truth seekers. And when you find a truth seeker, what do they do when they find wisdom? They accept it. They practice it. They enjoy it. They want to engage in it. That's who we're trying to find. We're not sowing our seed on the roadside. And you know, we're in better areas, you know, and places expect to find people that are like that. When the apostles were sent out and began all their preaching, and throughout the book of Acts as well, who did they go to first? Fellow Jews. Where did they go to find them? In the synagogues. Okay? When they were down by the river in Acts chapter 16. They're only there because they heard what? People that were meeting right there. Okay? The hardest thing for your mind is to be afraid of a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness or a Seventh-day Adventist or a Baptist or Episcopalian or any other, you know, religious group. Do not presume that they are in those groups because they believe that stuff. They're maybe just in a way station because they haven't found something that's better yet. So start there with people that already read the book, care about the book, believe in the book, try to practice the book. That's what Jesus and the apostles did. These are the people you start with. And then the rest, you know, highways and byways and that sort of thing, you may find some truth thinkers out there, but the likelihood, the probability is lower. It's seen that it's closer to the roadside. Think about that when you're out working with people. Greg, yeah,
I was thinking about the...
I'm sorry, Greg, I can't hear.
I was thinking about the sport part of it. People make games out of drinking. You know, there's drinking games or they'll see how many people they can fornicate with to make a sport out of it. Then you look at the games that you see among Christians. There's Bible trivia and there's the life of Paul.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a great point. And so, you know, we have Bible trivia games, and probably every house in, you know, that's represented here tonight's got those games too. You know, I think they're really very valuable. But that's the thing, is that you're trying also to develop, to carry Greg's point, you know, you're trying in your own heart to develop just an honest enjoyment of righteousness and of wisdom. And those things appeal to you. It's not something you have to work at. It's the sport that you enjoy. Okay, now 12:15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. Now, brother, I want to point out in the first part of chapter 12 and verse 15, the way of a wise man is right in his own eyes too, isn't it? It's not just a fool that thinks he's right. Are you wise because you think you're wrong? No. No, and so the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, and so is the way of a wise man right in his own eyes. But what's the difference in the last part of the verse? Both think they're right, but the wise man is listening, and the fool isn't. The fool is not hearing what you're saying. And that's another thing that just bugs me about, you know, TV shows. You know, I'm watching these shows, and it's very apparent that all of the sound bites had been prepared. They all had their list of the things they were, you know, going to say. And they're not really engaging each other. They're just throwing out slogans. You know, it's just frustrating. I can't watch that stuff. They're not developing arguments. If you're interested in politics, if you're interested in medicine, if you're interested in aerospace, if you're interested in anything, you know, there are better sources to find it than people that are just shouting over each other, giving short answers, never reaching any kind of a conclusion. A wise man is listening to counsel. You don't find counsel on those shows. You don't find a development of an argument. You don't find any in-depth kind of a study. There's no time for that. And so if we're going to acquire these things, we're not going to get them out of the popular media. We're going to have to separate ourselves from that and seek it elsewhere. 13:16. Every prudent man acts with knowledge, but a fool displays folly. Well, maybe could have gone in several different categories there, but the prudent man acts with his knowledge. The end of the Sermon on the Mount is pretty dramatic. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who what? Does the will
of my Father who is in heaven. The prudent man acts with the knowledge. Brethren, if there's anything I've experienced from by being a part of and then studying for 40 years, you know, denominational churches, is that these people who spend so much time associating with the Bible aren't practicing it. If they were practicing it, they would know the answer to the question, what must I do to be saved? They don't know that answer. And they don't give the Bible's answer. If they were actually interested in these things and acting with knowledge, they would be in churches that worship the way the Church of the Bible does. But they don't. They're in churches that have invented all kinds of different forms of worship you can't read there. If they were interested in acting with knowledge, they would be a part of a church that is organized like the church you read about in the Bible, wouldn't it? It would wear its name. It would do its works. But that's not the case. The prudent man acts with knowledge, but the fool is displaying his folly. Of course, he's wise in his own eyes, and he'll tell you at great length that it's wrong to argue. But he's not doing what Jesus said at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. He's not doing the will of the Father. He's just talking about it. We're trying to break that cycle and go like Jesus did to these Jews in the synagogues and the apostles after him, to try and encourage those who are dealing with the Bible and have some familiarity with it to act upon this knowledge. Rachel, you're next.
I'm not sure to get off the topic. I don't stop me if I am. I feel like it's for me, there's a kind of a disconnect where I'm trying to do everything I know how to do to live like God wants me to do. And I feel like people in my life don't have what I'm trying to do. But I don't have Bible study with them. And I have this very limited scope of people in my life that I have interaction with. And I have like kind of guilt that I don't even know how. I don't know.
Well, shame on you. Let me set your mind a little bit at ease. This is every, you know, tender-hearted preacher's just bane. My job is to motivate you to get out there and take the world for Christ, no prisoners. Okay? And in the process of trying to motivate people to do that, you know, it's difficult to properly apply the stages of life that you're in. Okay? Rachel, you are a young, about-to-be mother who has a full-time job. Okay? Well, I'll give it to you this way. My son called me up and said that he and his wife were reading a book. They read this book together. It takes them a long time to read the book. Whenever they have a chance, she'll read out loud to him. Next time he reads out loud to her, they're trying to get through the book. So, we just talked to him, and he recommended this book. I read the book in 15 hours. Now, how come I can read the book in one day, and it takes them weeks? These are close personal friends of Rachel. They're in your stage of life. And so as a preacher, I want you to understand that, and we know that. I'm not going to cut you much slack, but you know, I want you to recognize that there will be stages in your life where you will have the time to do these things. Get ready now, so that when the time and the opportunity presents itself, you can. The biggest mistake most people make is that when they are really too busy to have a wide acquaintance, you know, and all these opportunities and all the rest, you know, they're not really attending the classes, taking the time, you know, to try to acquire that body of data and that those skills at home. So that later you can. I have a lot more opportunity than you do now. See, my schedule is very different. I'm at a different stage in life. My kids are gone. You know, I don't have them. You know, wrapped around each ankle everywhere I try to go. I love those years, but you know, not as much happens in those years either. So what I'm saying is, don't carry any guilt, okay, and don't make any excuses, but properly evaluate where you are. All we're asking is that you are preparing yourself as best you can and seizing every opportunity you can. And ultimately, I'm here with more free time. You're paying me to have that time. Okay? So, hand the studies off to me. I'm not saying you necessarily all have to do the teaching. James 3:1 would suggest that's even dangerous. Be not many teachers, knowing what? shall receive a stricter judgment. Okay? But there are those who are free. See? So when you have the opportunity now, if you can't do it yourself, don't feel guilty about it, but hand it off. You know, the lightning rod is drawing these people. Bill, real quick, I've only got a few minutes. I'm really desperate to get done with these verses.
For myself, every one of us has different abilities, and a lot of us, you know, this up a week or two or three, have a fear of rejection. And to some of us, it's paralyzing. We don't want to be rejected. We don't want to have someone put us down, because if there's anything left to say, I can't say anymore. My mind's frozen.
Well, that's a fact. And we have talked about that quite a bit in recent classes. Overcoming that fear of rejection is one of the biggest things you got to do. That's just called courage, you know, getting used to it, developing a thick skin. Okay, so now, these are important considerations. I really do not mean to minimize them, but it would be better if we could finish these verses too, so we don't half and half next week. So let's try to go quickly at least through the rest of these. In 13:19, desire realized is sweet to the soul, but it is an abomination to fools to turn away from evil. Now, Solomon is a master at taking things that seem kind of disparate and maybe even unrelated, you know, and putting them together for us. Desire realized is sweet to the soul. I talked to a guy just yesterday. He's single. He doesn't have any children. He's lived his whole life on a dairy farm. And he's thinking about retirement, finally. And he wants to retire and live out the rest of his days in Hawaii. You got a problem with that? Well, when he gets there, I'll be happy as I can be for him. Desire realized is sweet to the soul. I hope he makes it. Okay? But after he paints that picture of how satisfying it is, he says it's an abomination of fools to turn away from evil. Now put the two together. What, brethren, should be really sweet to your soul? A desire realized. Put them together. Turning away from evil. See, we love it. That wisdom and that righteousness. So desire realized is sweet to the soul, but it's an abomination to fools to turn away from evil. He's trying to tell you how sweet and wonderful it is when you realize that desire to turn away from evil. You can do that. 14:8. We've got now three of them in chapter 14. 14:8. The wisdom of the sensible is to understand his way, but the foolishness of fools is deceit. This is another quality you might have put it up in how to identify a fool, but when you meet deceitful people, you catch them in their lies and their trickery. Well, you know, you're dealing with a fool, and it's the nature of his heart, and it might be wise, you know, to just, again, wave by light. 14:9, the next verse, fools mock at sin, but among the upright there is goodwill. Fools mock at sin. That is, anything the Bible or God would define as sin, and you're not going to stand up and defend, they're just going to mock. You know, if you are opposed to sin, they will find a way to you know, make jokes at your expense to try to make it seem that you're the foolish one. But among the upright, there's goodwill. So remember that as a quality of your heart and mind as you're working even with the fool. It would be easy to fall into the trap of just mocking the fool. And sometimes that is done. It can be done properly. Elijah did it with the prophets of Baal. Jesus did it on occasion. But it's fairly rare, I think. It requires, you know, certain circumstances. So be careful, you know. Among the upright, it's just goodwill and not a lot of mocking at all. That's a trademark and a hallmark of the fool. 14:24. The crown of the wise is their riches, but the folly of fools is foolishness. We touched on this quite a bit in the very early studies, and so on and go on. You know, this again, we've already studied this about what comes to those who are wise. But, you know, wise people do have a visible crown of their wisdom, and it is their success in this life. Also, in the realm of wisdom, we talked about that too, the folly of the fool is his foolishness. Now, 17:24. This is one of my favorite proverbs, personally. Wisdom is in the presence of the one who has understanding, but the eyes of the fool are on the ends of the earth. Now, what is that about?
Well, I think God is saying here, brethren, you see if you can agree. What he's saying is that in wisdom, you will discover that right here, right now, and within, you know, easy reach, you have everything you need. God will provide. He's promised to do so in the Old Testament and the New. You are not being tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will receive what? The way of escape. But you also, he wants you to enjoy this life. And so the wise individual is going to find all the answers to his problems, and he's going to be able to get through this world, you know, he's going to work everything out, and he's going to find that it probably won't be solved by investing in a copper mine in Peru. He'll probably be able to do it here at home, you know, where he lives. The eyes of the fool have always got this big dream scheme that's somewhere off in the distance, you know, this thing's, you know, going to happen. Again, we talked about this recently, so let us fly very quickly. But in our culture, you know, songs are sung and book titles are everything, you know, is there to just really glorify the idea that he was a dreamer. He had a dream. Well, if you have a goal, and you're wise enough to see how to get to that goal by employing the tools and opportunities that you have at your disposal, it would be great. But it is not good to be a dreamer. Where's the dreamer God? Ends of the earth. Always somewhere out there somewhere. You know, their problems are going to get solved right here at home in the meanwhile. You know, they're not making a living. Now I'm just going to go on. 14:16. Got those out of order, I guess. No one 14. A wise man is cautious and turns away from evil. But a fool is arrogant and careless. Again, maybe I should have put that up in identifying the fool. But put together with the wise man, here's the great contrast. Wise people are cautious and they turn away from evil in its every form. Not so. The fool is arrogant and careless. And then in 21, we only have two to go. 21:20, there is precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man swallows it up. We've already talked about that, along with 14:24, that the crown of the wise is their riches. So let's pass on that one, go to the last one. 28:26, brethren. He who trusts in his own heart is a fool. But he who walks wisely will be delivered. So after all of this study, you identify the fool, you have choices on how to handle the fool, okay? Ultimately, though, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool. Who are we trusting in? Our God and his word. He who walks wisely will what? You'll be delivered from the fool. You will be delivered from all things. And ultimately spend eternity in heaven as well. Okay, now hold on. Any kind of questions?